high level but indirect. According to media reports, Araghchi will be heading the Iranian team in the meetings, and the U.S. will be represented by U.S. Special Envoy for the Middle East, Steve Witkoff. Meanwhile, China urged the United States to show political sincerity and mutual respect in the nuclear talks with Iran after it unilaterally withdrew from the comprehensive agreement on the Iran nuclear issue.
At an emergency meeting with Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu, United States President Donald Trump shockingly claimed that Washington is about to hold direct talks with Tehran for the first time since 2018. Trump did not provide additional details, and just last week, only indirect talks were approved by Tehran.
We're having direct talks with Iran, and they've started. It'll go on Saturday. We have a very big meeting, and we'll see what can happen. And I think everybody agrees that doing a deal would be preferable to doing the obvious. And the obvious is not something that I want to be involved with.
That came after Trump openly threatened to bomb Iran, which was dismissed as not very probable by Iran leader Ayatollah Sayed Ali Khamenei. Trump is infamous for exaggerations, bluster, and untrustworthiness, as in his first term he failed to honor the 2015 JCPOA agreement on Iran's nuclear energy program. Trump's remarks seem to chagrin a scandal-ridden Netanyahu, who is repeatedly accused of trying to push Trump to expand the Israeli-U.S. genocide in Gaza into a disastrous all-out regional war.
To be manipulated to allow or participate in a war on Iran and destabilize the entire region. So we are hopeful that we can continue to push him because he himself expressed the desire and hope that he will be the president of peace. So on those bases, we urged him to hold Benjamin Netanyahu accountable, not to appease him and not to give him everything he wants.
With his predecessor, Joe Biden, launching war in Ukraine and immediately joining the Israeli genocide in Gaza, many believed Trump's campaign promises to avoid more endless, unwinnable wars.
President Trump has the opportunity to establish peace in the region that is based on justice and not further any escalation or start any wars. He told the world that he wants to end wars. He doesn't want to start ones. So he can do that. He has the ability, and I hope that he has the will. If he does otherwise, he will just destroy his own legacy by his own hands.
Tehran continues to stress that it approves of bilateral relations on, quote, equal footing, that it seeks peaceful relations and peaceful resolutions to current conflicts, and complained to the United Nations Security Council about Trump's, quote, reckless and belligerent and illegal threats. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
Over to China, who has vowed retaliation against the U.S. in response to Donald Trump's threat of additional tariffs. Chinese Ministry of Commerce said it would fight to the end following Trump's threat of an additional 50% tariff on Chinese imports. It also condemned Trump's tariffs as unilateral bullying. Beijing has emphasized that the countermeasures taken are aimed at protecting its sovereignty and security while maintaining the normal international trade order. The remarks come as Trump's sweeping tariffs have shaken markets globally, with many major indices experiencing the sharpest decline in years. Political analyst Chen Do-shu has weighed in on the U.S. President Donald Trump's threat of additional tariffs on China, calling it imperial bullying.
I think from the Chinese point of view, first of all, China does not have any intention to have an economic warfare with Washington. For every country that is truly sovereign, that is truly independent, you have to defend your own sovereignty. You defend your interests by legitimate means, because that's what you need to do for your people, for your nation, statehood. If you have a problem such as Washington, they have, you need to talk to like your trading partners to solve such a problem, to express your concern and find a way to solve the problem, a legitimate way under the international trading system. So far, obviously, Washington is not doing that. They are bullying basically every economy, every country. They are threatening with more tariffs on the goods from other countries. So this is a practice of a unilateral and imperial bullying, of other countries. I think that's unacceptable for a lot of countries, including China. So I think China is resolute, saying that, you know, we have to defend our interests. If there are more tariffs upon the Chinese good, we will take appropriate measures to do, our basically turn, our round, to protect our interests.
Staying with Trump's tariff war, the U.S. president has responded to the EU's 0-for-0 tariff offer by demanding that the bloc must buy $350 billion worth of energy from Washington to get tariff relief. Trump made the comments during a press conference at the White House with visiting Israeli premier. He added that the EU's offer of zero tariffs is not enough to cover the bloc's $350 billion trade deficit with the U.S. The EU offered a two-way zero tariff for American and EU products after Trump slapped 20% tariff on the bloc and 10% on all U.S. trading partners.
EU leaders and companies are reeling and markets are plunging as Trump's tariffs, ranging from 20 to 27.5%, are hitting EU exports to the US worth €380 billion. The 27-nation bloc's foreign ministers held emergency talks on Monday, and afterwards it was revealed that Trump, for now, is not willing to negotiate.
Despite of efforts and opening, we haven't seen the real engagement which would lead to the mutually acceptable solution, because it has to be fair for both sides.
Eurosceptic to the core, Trump has refused to engage with EU chief Ursula von der Leyen, reportedly because he does not recognize her authority to negotiate on behalf of the bloc. She was asked about this on Monday, but declined to address the snub directly.
We are open for negotiations, and that in parallel we are preparing a potential list for retaliation and other measures for retaliation if this is necessary.
Member states of the EU are divided on how hard to strike back against Trump with countermeasures.
There is no unity in this 27-member bloc about what's going to happen. And this is in the advantage of Donald Trump, because he can say, okay, this is something which I can make some leverage about.
EU officials say it's the biggest disruption to global trade since World War II. The significance of the shift is not lost on European citizens.
There'll be job losses, I think, definitely, because people they won't be able to afford to keep as many people on.
I don't really understand why he's doing it, because he will hurt himself. That's my point of view. So, yeah, well, it's a loss-loss situation, I think.
It's going to be more expensive to live and to do all your goods, import, export, so it is going to affect the economy.
The big questions now, how far will this trade war go, and what could it mean for already hard-pressed EU consumers who are looking to their political leaders to stand up to Trump on this and a whole range of other issues too? Jerome Hughes at the Council of the EU. Brussels.
The Israeli regime presses ahead with its genocidal onslaught against the Gaza Strip, killing more civilians in the devastated Palestinian territory. In the latest developments, an early morning attack targeting a house killed at least six Palestinians and injured several others in Beit Lahia, northern Gaza. Over a dozen Palestinians were also killed and many more wounded in similar attacks on residential buildings in central Gaza. Other parts of the Palestinian territory, including Rafah, were also targeted by multiple air and artillery attacks, causing dozens of fatalities. Also, a journalist succumbed to his wounds sustained in a Monday attack on a camp of media workers in the southern city of Khan Yunis. The attack left another journalist killed and a number of others wounded. The total death toll from since October 2023 now stands at over 50,750, with nearly 115,480 others injured. The heads of six UN agencies have issued a grave warning on the situation in Gaza. They called for the immediate resumption of the ceasefire in the territory amid a deepening humanitarian crisis. The agencies warned of severe aid shortages and hunger since Israel resumed its all-out aggression on March the 18th. They said for over a month, no commercial or humanitarian supplies have entered Gaza. After Israel blocked the entry of aid trucks, the agencies noted that more than 2.1 million people are trapped, bombed, and starved again, while food, medicine, fuel, and other supplies are piling up behind Gaza's closed crossings. The agencies added that at least 1,000 children were killed or injured during the first week after the Israeli genocide resumed, which is the highest one-week children death toll in the past year. Well, now joining us for the latest developments there from Gaza City is our correspondent, Ghada Ibrahim Al-Zabout. Ghada, I just want to say, I mean, as we continue to say that the genocide is continuing, genocide is nothing normal. These people are not simply numbers. They are people with families, with names, with lives that are being taken from them. I mean, latest reports are saying that basic food is being considered as a luxury and extremely expensive, as we just now mentioned, that has been 37 days since any type of humanitarian aid or food has been able to enter Gaza. Beheaded children, starvation, people being burned alive is definitely nothing even close to something normal. Ghada, what updates do you have for us since the last time we spoke?
Yes, as you mentioned, exactly, genocide is not something normal, and you cannot live easily with a genocide taking place. The situation in Gaza remains very tense. The airstrikes do not stop targeting civilian infrastructure and people's residential homes and neighborhoods. Just in the last hour, an airstrike targeted the Palestinian home in Beit Lahia that killed at least six Palestinians from Aish family. Many are still even buried under the rubble of that home, and many were injured actually by this target. So every passing hour, the situation gets more deteriorated, and the injuries increase to influx here in to the hospital of Al Mamadani in the heart of Gaza, and the damage actually increases. The humanitarian crisis deepens as well. So the humanitarian situation after 40 days now of complete closure and complete control of Gaza's border crossing by the Israeli regime, nothing entered Gaza, no food, no aid, no medical supplies. The hospital here and all the hospitals of Gaza are overwhelmed by the sheer volume of the casualties and by the injuries, as the medical supplies are consumed very rapidly because of the injuries. And because of the continuous airstrikes taking place and all over the places of the Gaza Strip. So since the morning of yesterday till now, at least 70 people were killed, many of them were children, women, and these indiscriminate attacks targeted civilians, targeted journalists, targeted doctors, no place is away from the Israeli airstrikes or the Israeli fire now in Gaza.
Yes, well, Ghada Ibrahim Al-Zabout, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us from Gaza City. Well, in Gaza and the West Bank, recent Israeli attacks have killed a number of medics and civil defense teams while on duty. Our West Bank correspondent, Aqal Hamad, has sent us a report on the deliberate targeting and execution of eight Palestinian Red Crescent paramedics in Rafah, southern Gaza.
In the early hours of March 31st, eight Palestinian Red Crescent paramedics were killed in what the organization now calls a direct, deliberate targeting by Israeli forces. These weren't casualties of crossfire or tragic mistakes. This was a precision strike on an emergency response team fully marked and documented. The incident, confirmed by the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, is not an isolated event. Across Gaza and the West Bank, paramedics, doctors, and rescue workers have increasingly become targets themselves. But the massacre in Rafah, where the medics were reportedly buried beneath a thin layer of sand, reveals the regime's intent to silence even the protectors of life.
The occupation forces are trying to cover up their crimes as much as they can. They target women, children, and journalists. Also, this is not the first time to be attacked. Our crews have been under fire since day one. The Israeli army repeatedly claims the Red Crescent uses ambulances to transport fighters or weapons. Yet in 50 years, no such claim has ever been proven.
According to PRCS, documents and satellite images that were presented in a press conference reveal the circumstances of the strike and prove the crew's visibility and non-combat status.
Recently, the army said ambulances weren't lit and crews weren't in uniform. Claims refuted by video evidence shown at the UN Security Council. The footage clearly showed well-lit vehicles and fully uniformed crews. We demand an independent international investigation into the deliberate killing of medical teams and accountability for these grave violations.
As medics fall under fire, the rules of war seems to dissolve. Israel's targeting of emergency response teams protected under international humanitarian law raises grave legal and ethical concerns.
This is a clear-cut war crime. The Israelis did not only commit the war crime, but they tried to cover up for it. Paramedics enjoy special protection under international humanitarian law.
What was buried in Rafah was more than eight bodies. It was the very principle that even in war, some lines must not be crossed. But as Gaza continues to burn, those lines have not only been crossed, they've been erased. Israel may have tried to cover the bodies of the victims with thin sand, but the voice of the dead, the bones of the paramedics of Rafah, now echo louder than expected. Amid silence and double standards, the world must decide, will these crimes be buried or will they be exposed? Naqa' Hamid, Ramallah, Occupied West Bank.
Please stay tuned for more updates. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is Arabi English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir. iranradio.ir.
the limelight.
The Trump administration says it inadvertently told some Ukrainian refugees they needed to leave the United States immediately because their legal status was being revoked. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered the story and tells us more. The Trump administration on Friday, 4th of April, said it accidentally told some Ukrainian refugees they needed to leave the United States immediately because their legal status was being revoked, telling CBS News the message was sent by mistake. Some Ukrainians who had entered the United States under the Biden administration following the eruption of war with Russia received emails this week telling them that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security would be terminating their legal protections, according to advocates and a notice obtained by CBS News. The Department of Homeland Security is now exercising its discretion to terminate your parole, the 3rd of April notice said, referring to the temporary legal status that the Biden administration granted to hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians. The email added, unless it expires sooner, your parole will terminate 7 days from the date of this notice. The Biden administration welcomed roughly 240,000 Ukrainians under a policy known as Uniting for Ukraine, or U for U, that allowed Americans to sponsor Ukrainians displaced by the war. More than 20,000 Ukrainians who flew to Mexico at the start of the war were also allowed into the United States under the parole authority, which allows officials to offer temporary work permits and deportation protections to migrants on humanitarian grounds. If recipients failed to leave the United States, the message said, they would be subject to potential law enforcement actions that will result in your removal from the United States, unless they have received another immigration status. The notice also said recipients would lose their work permits once their parole status was revoked, and encouraged them to sign up for self-deportation using a government smartphone app known as CBP Home that the Trump administration recently repurposed. Again, the Department of Homeland Security is terminating your parole. Do not attempt to remain in the United States. The federal government will find you, the notice warned. Please depart the United States immediately. But when CBS News asked representatives for Department of Homeland Security about the notice, they said it has been sent erroneously. It was an error. A message was sent in error to some Ukrainians under the U for U program, Department of Homeland Security said in a statement. The U for U parole program has not been terminated. The agency also took the step of retracting the email on Friday, writing to recipients in a second email. The second email read, "You may have received an email notification titled Notice of Termination of Parole. The Department of Homeland Security sent this email to you in error. No action will be taken with respect to your parole." It is unclear just how many Ukrainians received the government's email. While the Trump administration has not formally terminated the Uniting for Ukraine program, it suspended admissions under the policy as well as status renewals for those already in the United States. Despite the Trump administration's statement that it sent the termination notices inadvertently, advocates continue to worry officials could still attempt to strip Ukrainians of their legal status in the future. As part of its sweeping crackdown on illegal and legal immigration, the Trump administration has moved to dismantle Biden administration immigration programs that relied on the parole authority. It has discontinued a sponsorship initiative for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans, and warned the more than 500,000 migrants who came to the United States under the policy that they would face arrest and deportation if they did not self-deport by 24th of April. The website Politico has also covered the same story. Ukrainians living in the United States legally received an email in error on Friday, 4th of April, from the Department of Homeland Security, telling them that their parole status had been revoked and that they must self-deport, according to a Trump administration official. It wasn't immediately clear how many people received the email notification, which caused widespread panic among people who fled the war and have been on edge since President Donald Trump said last month that he may revoke their temporary legal residency status. As of yet, the United States has not terminated the temporary parole status granted to 240,000 Ukrainians who fled the war under President Joe Biden, according to Tricia McLaughlin, a spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security. The move to reverse it, which has been telegraphed by the White House in recent months, will potentially place hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians on track to be quickly deported. The email, first reported by Migrant Insider, spurred immediate confusion as lawmakers began to receive calls from constituents about the notifications. Many Ukrainians were already bracing for such a directive from the Trump administration, part of a broader effort to strip legal status from nearly 2 million people who are allowed to stay in the United States through temporary humanitarian parole programs under former President Joe Biden. Donald Trump has already ordered the end of parole status for about 530,000 Venezuelans, Cubans, and Haitians, and said last month that he was considering doing the same for Ukrainians, who were part of a wave of refugees who fled at the start of the war. Donald Trump told reporters in the Oval Office last month, when asked about revoking Ukrainian status, he said, "We're not looking to hurt anybody. We're certainly not looking to hurt them. And I'm looking at that." Trump added, "There were some people that think that's appropriate and some people don't, and I'll be making the decision pretty soon." A spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security did not say whether a final determination had been made and when the notifications were intended to go out. On his first day in office, Donald Trump called on Department of Homeland Security officials to terminate all categorical parole programs as part of a slew of immigration executive orders. He also paused admissions under a program for Ukrainians, Uniting for Ukraine, soon after he took office on 20th of January, barring those already in the United States from renewing their two-year protections and work permits and halting new admissions.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, no words can describe what we're witnessing taking place in Gaza, and no one outside of the Strip can really fathom what it is like to be in Gaza and go through this Holocaust. 18 months of sheer madness and hell as billions of people in this dystopian world just watch while Palestinians are being starved to death, buried alive, beheaded, torn to pieces, burned alive, kidnapped and tortured. Just about every other sadistic crime imaginable has been committed against them by this U.S. Zionist genocide. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Mazen Gorm Said, Palestinian scientist and author out of Bethlehem. And Fra Hughes, journalist, author, and activist out of Belfast. Well, thank you both for being with me. Let me start this off in Bethlehem. I mean, Mazen, it gets just more and more difficult to talk about this. Every day, of course, that's the very least that we can do when our Palestinian brothers and sisters are going through the sheer hell. Obviously, not only in Gaza, but we also were going to get into the West Bank, too. Now, Mazen, the regime targeted in the middle of the night a tent housing journalists that caught a fire and burnt people alive. I mean, what does this mean exactly? People are being targeted who have been displaced, who are living in tents. And why journalists? We have 232 journalists, at least, that have been killed in Gaza since October of 2023. Why?
Well, this is, as you pointed out, this is unprecedented, and it leaves us pretty much speechless. I mean, it's very hard to even convey the level of horror. When you mentioned the number of journalists killed in about a year and a half or less, that's more journalists than killed in the last wars in the past 100 years combined, you know, combined. Even World War II and World War I, when you add all the journalists killed in them, you wouldn't get that number. And that's journalists alone. And then, of course, medical personnel. And, of course, children. This is targeting children because 50% of the Gaza population is children. And one incident, 8 of the 15 people killed were children. So this levels of horrors, levels of, you know, depravity that the Zionist regime has gone down the road in with the support of Western powers, Western governments, is unprecedented in world history, and really, what can I say? I mean, as I said, it's very hard for me to articulate how frustrated and angry we are at the silence and seeing Netanyahu strut himself in Hungary, and now the U.S. right-wing fascist governments that support him.
Yes, indeed. Well, Fra, I mean, Mazen talked about the hypocrisy of these Western entities, but what about professional organizations? I mean, why isn't there more of an international outcry from professional journalist organizations regarding this targeting of journalists?
Well, I think the immediate answer that comes to mind is whoever pays the paper calls the tune. These professional journalists that you're alluding to, I don't know how professional they are. I thought the idea of journalism was holding truth to power. But what they are they are bought assets. They are very similar in their construction, and they are very similar in their attitude to the bought assets of the political systems across Western political society. These people who write for The Guardian, The Times, The New York Times, Le Monde, Die Welt, all these different prestigious international journals, they are all paid assets of the people who are their employers. Their employers are just as complicit as the Zionist government in covering up the murders of the innocent people in Gaza, the men, the women, and the children. So when we talk about journalism and we talk about free speech and we talk about holding truth to power, none of this exists. The illusion in the West that we live in a democracy is slowly being worn away by the resilience of the people in Palestine and Yemen and Iran, who show constantly that it is the naked hypocrisy, it is the lies, it is the propaganda. When we think that the first casualty of war is truth, what we're witnessing is a propaganda war by the mainstream media in the West to create the conditions within society here to allow some form of ongoing almost acceptance of what is happening 4,000 miles away from Britain, you know, God knows how many miles away from America. But while the mainstream media continues to lie, while it continues to defend Israel as if it has a right to murder innocent men, women, and children in self-defense, as it claims, we will continue to have a compliant media leading to a compliant society where people make real against what's happening, but they're not even, I can guarantee you, I live in the West, and we are not shown the truth on a regular basis or a daily basis of what's happening in West Asia. We are constantly being bombarded with propaganda, state narrative, and the Israeli cover of anti-Semitism. But anyone who stands up for the truth and tries to expose these heinous war crimes, there have recently been 8 IOF soldiers who have returned to Britain who are British nationals. They're walking the streets free. These men should be questioned, arrested, interrogated, and prosecuted for the war crimes in Gaza. But they are walking free, and this is Western society and Western establishment showing its true face to the world.
Yes, indeed. Well, Mazen, earlier atrocities include the targeted killing of 15 medics who were assassinated by the regime. Now, the level of inhumanity is unimaginable, but continually happening on a daily basis. In your perspective, why is the regime so ruthless and targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure as it continues to do?
Well, Zionism from the beginning wanted to obliterate our existence in Palestine. That's a whole game of Zionism. They want the land without the people who come with the land. And even the land, they want to reshape it to fit their own agenda by destroying indigenous trees, olive trees, fig trees, almond trees, etc., and plant European pine trees. They want to make Palestine a European country without its indigenous humans, plants, and animals. This is the whole idea of Zionism. This is the whole idea of colonialism, of course, as practiced in what became as Australia or United States. So this is expected from colonialists, and it is also expected, of course, as pointed out by the other guest, that there are resistance to these, resistance actions to these plans of ethnic cleansing, genocide, ecocide, scholasticide, medicide, killing of, trying to destroy. I mean, all the mosques pretty much in Gaza are gone. 3 churches are destroyed, including 3rd oldest church in Palestine. So this is expected. They want to destroy anything that does not fit their vision of a Jewish state, a Europeanized Jewish state.
Okay. Well, Fra, the Israeli regime is starving people to death, beheading them, burying them alive, and so much more. We've seen people flying in the air due to the velocity of bombs exploding. I mean, when it seems the situation can't get any worse, as I said, in Gaza, then the regime does something even more sadistic. It has been given a free hand. What is its end aim, in your perspective? What's the end game for Israel?
Yes, well, what we're witnessing at the moment is hell on earth. It's the only way to describe what's happening on the ground in Gaza and indeed the West Bank. For people who believe in heaven and hell, for people who believe that you know, hell is a place where people will be tortured for eternity. That's what we're witnessing in Gaza. That's what we're witnessing in the West Bank and in Lebanon and in Syria. But the end game is obvious. It is a white European colonial occupation of Palestine. We're witnessing total war. We're witnessing the use of armaments. We're witnessing the use of torture and brutality. We're witnessing the use of the destruction of the medical facilities, the infrastructure for the water, the fuel, and using starvation as a method of subjugation against the Palestinian people. The message they're sending is surrender or die, and if they surrender, then expulsion will be next. It is the plan of the colonizer to displace and then replace the indigenous population. So this is a scorched earth policy. What we appear to be witnessing now is that as they move the population around, they send the evacuation orders in order to clear a kind of field of fire, and then they go in and destroy all the buildings. So the end plan, whether or not they succeed is a different matter, is to leave no building standing in Gaza, to have the people not even living in tents or porta cabins, but to be surrounded by a military force that is shooting people at will with impunity and with the backing of Europe and the United States, America and Canada. So the end plan is the total extermination or expulsion or extradition of the indigenous population. But we all know it won't end there. They want parts of Egypt, they want Iraq, they want parts of Lebanon, and they want to go as far as they can towards Saudi Arabia with Iraq's Greater Israel project. So the Palestinians now are fighting the same fascism that the Russians fought during the Second World War. They have been dehumanized, they have been slaughtered, they have been shot at for fun. The murder of those 15 humanitarian aid workers, as far as I'm aware, that was coordinated with the Israelis, that those ambulances would be allowed into that area to recover the dead and the wounded. That became a trap. Those people were lured in and they were summarily executed, and the autopsies appeared to show that their hands were tied behind their backs. They were shot in the head at close range, and it's part of the psychological war that no one is safe in Gaza, no matter what part of civil society you're from. No one is safe anywhere at any time. They will murder the innocent. They will murder those who come initially as the first responders to help save human life, which is a natural human reaction to run towards the aid of others in distress, and then to murder the very people and medics who try to save them, and then murder the doctors in the hospitals who try to save what's left.
Right. Well, Mazen, you're in Bethlehem. You're about 73 kilometers from Gaza. Tell me, what is it like right now for the Palestinians on the West Bank in general? I mean, knowing that it's been over a month that the regime has not allowed any food supplies or aid in, and of course the 18 months that this has been going on, and now of course we are seeing increased aggression against the West Bank itself, but to know that you're just 73 kilometers from there and yet basically helpless as far as helping them.
Well, the situation in central Palestine, the West Bank, is unfolding similar to what happened in the Gaza Strip. And it's a slow process, of course, much less intense than what's happening in the Gaza Strip. But nevertheless, it's going on. I mean, just yesterday, they killed a 14-year-old Palestinian child who's a dual citizen, actually, a U.S. citizen also, and the U.S. didn't even flinch about that. This is in the West Bank. The destruction of homes continues in the refugee camps. In Bethlehem, where I live, is three refugee camps. They are being targeted, Aida, Azza, and the Haisha camp. And in the Haisha camp, the largest one, they came in and distributed flyers basically warning or threatening people that they will do to that refugee camp what they did to the refugee camps in the north of the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, which is complete demolition of these sites. And you can see the pictures on your screen, of course, of what the Israeli military is doing as it destroys homes, as it destroys livelihoods of people, as it impoverishes people in the West Bank. Similar, as I said, to what they had done in Gaza Strip, destroying infrastructure like roads and electricity grids and water supply and so on, but also homes and clinics and other facilities. So it is an unfolding horror that is going to expand to the West Bank at a much larger scale. So how do we feel in the West Bank? We feel, of course, trepidations and anger at the international community for this, their silence about what happened in Gaza, what is happening in Gaza, and what is happening now increasingly in the West Bank. The loss of our humanity, the loss of international law, basically the ending of the UN as a functioning agency, and the ignorance of International Criminal Court and International Court of Justice rulings.
Well, Fra, do you think that the violence of the regime in the West Bank will backfire on it? I mean, as the attacks and the destruction of Palestinian homes will lead to more people joining the resistance, because basically there's nothing else that they can do, and increase retaliatory operations against the Zionist regime.
Well, we've seen very little retaliatory actions against the regime because the people are very limited, I would imagine. I'm sitting straight to my home thousands of miles, and I've been in Gaza in 2010 with George Galloway. I've visited the occupied territories on three different occasions. I've been to the refugee camp in Bethlehem. I've been to Nabi Sali for the Friday protest. The people are very, very, very limited in their scope. I mean, they're facing the fourth largest army in the world. They have tanks, they have airplanes, they have artilleries, they have armored vehicles, and they have no conscience, no mercy, and no compassion. This is the people that they're facing. A very small armed resistance that we've witnessed previously in Jenin finds it very difficult to stand up against an army which is basically financed, armed, and then rearmed by the American administration. Let's not forget the 600,000 babies that died in Iraq under the sanctions, and then a million people murdered in Iraq by America and Britain in their illegal war. It's, you know, it's amazing that the resistance in both Gaza and in the West Bank can do as much as they are actually doing in the face of this murderous onslaught. So all we can do is, under international law, is to acknowledge the right that people living under occupation have to resist that occupation by any and all means necessary. So from 4,000 miles away, all I can do is watch almost helplessly what's happening on the ground in both Gaza and in the West Bank. And, you know, we're watching this unfold in real time, a genocide on our screens, a genocide on our phones, and our colleague is 100% correct. The impotency of the UN, it's all been shattered. All the illusions of the West talking about, military intervention to protect human rights in Libya when NATO bombed Libya, and the murderous death of Muammar Gaddafi. So the West is totally complicit in all this. The people in Palestine have the right to resist. It's potentially all they can do, but they're being corralled into smaller and smaller and smaller areas and being surrounded more and more and more by a merciless military onslaught, by people who are supremacists, by people who are racists, and by people who have no value for human life other than their own. If you're not Jewish and you're not a Zionist, they have no respect for the human life of the other, and no respect for the values of anyone who is not of their supremacist.
Right, right. Well, Mazen, tell me, what's the mindset of the young people that you're around in Bethlehem, in the West Bank right now? I mean, Tell me, just give me the vibe, what they're saying.
Well, most young people in the West Bank are, of course, like young people everywhere. They long for a decent life. They long for jobs. They long for having their freedom to move about, to travel even. Most of them are not even allowed to travel 5 kilometers, let's say, from Bethlehem to Jerusalem to visit the holy sites or pray at their holy sites, whether the Christian holy sites or the Muslim holy sites in Jerusalem are off limits to us. So the young people are, of course, frustrated, pained, and angry, and they watch in amazement as the rest of the world, again, chucks these Israeli violations aside, puts them aside, and focuses on selling more weapons to that regime, giving more weapons to that regime, and protecting it from international law. The young people in Palestine, there were demonstrations actually today. Thousands of people were out in the streets, as there was also a strike to basically calling for a stop for this ongoing crimes against humanity. So our people, like those people you also see on your screen, internationals who are acting, our young people are also acting, although we are under more severe restrictions than those younger people in other countries. But of course, that's coming in other countries, repression, as you know, in Europe and the US against young people protesting. Many students also lost their positions at the universities inside the United States for simply speaking out about human rights.
Right. And just I have just about 30 seconds. Fra, what message would you want to give to people around the world if they're not involved at all? I mean, what do you see as their responsibility in dealing with this genocide?
Well, people can't get involved in coming out onto the streets if they can't get involved in civil disobedience, if they can't get involved in trying to prevent arms shipments from leaving the different ports and airports all over Western Europe, then what they must do is BDS. What they must do is boycott, divest, sanction, and they must raise their voices, and they must stand shoulder to shoulder the people being oppressed and murdered in Palestine. So if you can't do anything, join the boycott movement and try to economically put some pressure on the Zionist apartheid racist state.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. Mazen Qomsai, Palestinian scientist and author out of Bethlehem. Fra Hughes, journalist, author, and activist out of Belfast. Thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Why there is a need for a government which will be established by the Wali of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
In one of the letters that he writes to Sheikh Mufid, he tells us one of the ways that we can end the ghiba.
Let us see how one can prepare for the advent of the zuhur of Imam Mahdi, Sahib al-Zaman.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam al-Mahdi, alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. Please stay tuned. The 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, is the one who brings hope to all of humanity. As the world is being grinded between the oppressors and tyrants of the age, we look towards the heavens so that the advent of the 12th divinely appointed Imam comes sooner. We raise our hands in prayers and we raise our hands in supplications, so that the awaited Savior of humanity comes and brings the final hope and salvation that humanity is so yearning for and desiring. The sights and the eyes of the world are looking towards the advent of this great Savior, Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance so that his eminence comes to establish the divine rule of the Almighty Allah for every single human being, is completely dependent and needs this divine rule of the Almighty Allah. And it is this divine rule of the Almighty Allah, the kingdom of God that is to be established by Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, which will bring about ultimate justice in a world which is filled with cruelty and injustice. Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about the dialogues of the 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. This is an interesting conversation and a dialogue that Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, has with a group of Shia. Now, the situation was such that there was another group of Shia, including a man by the name of Ibn Abi Ghanam Qazwini. And this individual, along with a couple of other Shia people that he had gathered apparently around him, these people, they denied the existence of the 12th divinely appointed Imam. So the Shias who believed in the existence of the 12th divinely appointed Imam, they spoke with him and had a dialogue with him and you know, told His Eminence what was happening. And so in response, we find that Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, says that, "I am not afraid if someone turns away from us. And we are the first creations of our Lord, and other creatures and people were created afterwards. And you, O people, why have you fallen into doubt and bewilderment?" So here, in this just a few sentences, we find that first and foremost, His Eminence Imam al-Mahdi shows his bravery and his courage.